is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. There have been several big victories for Native American rights in the last week. One from the Supreme Court on tribal lands in Oklahoma, another from a federal court on the Dakota Access Pipeline, and then there's the announcement that Washington, D.C.'s football team will change its name. We'll talk about the significance of these changes and what they mean for Native American rights. First, let's talk about the Supreme Court ruling and the potential huge implications it will have for criminal justice on tribal land. Joining us now to talk about the case and its history, we have Jonadev Chowdhury, an ambassador to the Creek Nation and former Chief Justice of the Muscogee Nation Supreme Court. Ambassador, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us, Sarah Deer. She's a professor at the University of Kansas and a citizen of the Muscogee Nation in Oklahoma. Professor Deer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Also with us, Professor Kent Blansett, Associate Professor of Indigenous Studies and History at the University of Kansas. He's a Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, Shawnee, and Potawatomi descendant. Professor Blansett, welcome back to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor Deer, first of all, because we may use these terms interchangeably, could you clarify the difference between Muscogee and Creek?
Between Muscogee and Creek?
Yes.
Same thing. Our official name is the Muscogee and then parentheses Creek Nation. And so both of those terms apply to citizens of our nation.
So, Professor Deer, give us an overview of how this case began, the Supreme Court case, and its results.
Well, it started in 1996, if you can believe that. Unfortunately, we had a very sad situation. A Seminole man molested some children, or at least one child, on the reservation back in 1996. He was prosecuted by the state of Oklahoma and received a sentence of over 1,000 years, one of those draconian, very lengthy sentences. And he appealed his case. And one of the things that he argued was that because the crime took place within the boundaries of the Creek Reservation, the wrong government prosecuted him. In a reservation, typically the federal government and the tribal government would have authority. So the question really became not whether he did it or not, or whether he should be in prison, but whether or not the reservation still exists. And believe it or not, in 2020, that was still up in the air. So this was a huge victory for McGirt, who will probably be tried by federal court now. But it established and reminded us that the Creek Reservation, promised in a treaty of 1866, is still valid. And that was the huge victory for not only the Muscogee Creek Nation, but for Indian country across the nation.
And explain a little bit more specifically about what the ruling does.
So the ruling reaffirms that there is a Creek reservation in Oklahoma. We had stated that for a long time. It's in our Constitution, right, that our reservation exists. But there was not a clear answer from the courts as to whether it exists. So this was the first time that we really had to assert ourselves as a nation and claim that reservation as rightly ours.
Professor Blansett, the United States had many treaties with Native American tribes and also broke many of them. Talk about some of the history of broken promises over land.
I think a lot of this goes back especially to the 1830s and looking at a lot of the Supreme Court cases that were coming out, mostly known as the Marshall decisions, which is Cherokee v. Georgia and the Worcester decision. Which reaffirmed our sovereignty and also basically backed up that the state governments had no rights in regards to jurisdiction over Native nations, that we were to be seen at that point and moving forward as independent or quasi-dependent nations, but on the same level with the federal government. And out of that, of course, the Indian Removal Act was something that was seen as a policy to remove all Native peoples as we were living east of the Mississippi, west of the Mississippi, which would be today to Indian territory. And then, of course, what would happen out of this is that Supreme Court decisions would be raised as a challenge to that inaction. In the state of Georgia, and of course, a lot of the South was eager to get a lot of our lands, mainly because they were looking to expand not only slavery, but they were wanting to expand King Cotton throughout the South. And a lot of their lands were basically over-tilled and over-processed, and of course, looking to evict us. Andrew Jackson, who was president at the time, essentially basically just did nothing and allowed General Winfield Scott and the military to begin forcefully removing our people west of the Mississippi. And these forced marches with bayonets at our backs became typically known as the Trail of Tears, and multiple nations, Creek, Choctaw, Cherokee, Seminole, Chickasaws, we all faced our own version of these Trail of Tears. For the Cherokee Nation, we would lose over half of our people. And then, of course, as Dr. Deere mentioned earlier, during the Civil War, that last treaty in 1866 was a reparations treaty. And out of this, even in, we failed to understand that we would lose another half of our population during the course of the Civil War, just in the fighting that would ensue. And obviously, the state of Oklahoma and these decisions tried to use history to its own benefit, but ignored really what was happening and the true case of what was going on with the Civil War, which there was an internal Civil War, even among the Cherokee and the Creek and other nations. And Potheola was one of those famous leaders of the Creek that sided with the Union during the Civil War and led troops back into Indian territory against Stan Waite and others during that time period. And so these reparation treaties, essentially in 1866, for us to come back into the Union after having sided with the Confederacy, which is a very longer story than what we can get into today. Those reparation treaties were meant to take away those Western lands and then, of course, instill and protect our Eastern lands in what was then Indian Territory. And of course, that is confirmed now by the Supreme Court that those lands are in fact reservation lands and shall be protected as such. And of course, the state has no jurisdiction over that regards to the criminal case.
Well, we got this message from Sue on Facebook who says, I am a white person, but rejoiced when I heard about the verdicts. Too often treaties were broken and left Native Americans losing more and more. This is a small victory, but a victory. Ambassador Chowdhury, how has the response been in Oklahoma at large? And we've only got about a minute here.
Well, first of all, the Creek Nation has a long history of working with other governments, and we're committed to doing that to protect all public health, safety, and welfare. So we are here. We've been in cooperative talks with our partners about how to address all transition items. That said, in any period of transition, there are going to be, you know, ongoing matters that we will need to address. By and large, the decision has been celebrated universally, not only among Creek citizens and Native people, but also many, many citizens of Tulsa. We're very happy to see that the Tulsa mayor voiced support of the decision, as well as many other elected officials and citizens. So by and large, everybody understands that this decision was not only legally right, but consistent with what Tulsa is. And Tulsa comes from a Creek word that stems from Tallahassee, Old Town.
Coming up, we'll take more of your questions and comments about the recent Supreme Court ruling about tribal lands in Oklahoma. We're speaking with Ambassador Jonadav Chowdhury, Professor Sarah Deere, and Professor Kent Blansett. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
What does it mean to be the only person who looks like you at your place of work?
I was the first Latina in the newsroom at NPR ever to step foot who wasn't cleaning it.
We discussed the reckoning over race taking place in newsrooms across the country. Listen and subscribe now to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Jen White. We're talking about the 5-4 Supreme Court ruling that decided about half of Oklahoma is Native American land. We're with Jonadev Chowdhury, an ambassador to the Creek Nation and former Chief Justice of the Muscogee Nation Supreme Court, Professor Sarah Deer, professor at the University of Kansas and a citizen of the Muscogee Nation in Oklahoma, and Professor Kent Blansett, Associate Professor of Indigenous Studies and History at the University of Kansas. He is Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, Shawnee, and Potawatomi descended. Professor Deer, we got this tweet from Randy who asks, wasn't the Muscogee tribe originally in the east? They were then moved out west by the U.S. government, correct? Can you provide some clarification for Randy?
Yes, that's correct. And Dr. Blansett, I think, addressed this. We were originally in what is now the southeastern part of the United States. We had a very successful economy in the early 19th century, but unfortunately, we couldn't win the political battle and keep our land. So we were forced to Indian Territory on what most people remember as the Trail of Tears. As Muscogee people, we call it the Road of Suffering. It was a very, very long journey on foot. People froze to death. People died along the way, especially young people and elders. We arrived at Indian Territory very, very exhausted and having lost a significant number of our people. So it's a time of great tragedy for the southeastern tribes.
Well, Joseph on Facebook writes, it's one step forward. It's a start. Maybe our great government could also start honoring all the broken treaties, plus tell the truth about the genocide the government has committed against our people. Ambassador Chowdhury, put this decision into larger context for us. When we think about the gaps in history and how it's told, when we think about broken treaties and broken promises for the U.S. government, how does this decision land for you within that larger context?
Well, we're no longer strangers in our own land. And that's a very personal, profound feeling for any Muscogee citizen. And what I mean by that is, even though many of us have been told throughout our whole lives, you are Muscogee. This is your home. This is your community. You come from Georgia, Alabama, northern Florida, but we've made the Tulsa area and Muscogee Creek Nation, as we know it in Oklahoma, our home. Even though we were told that, there was always this perception among some quarters that it wasn't our home. Now, legalistic minutiae aside, the symbolic importance of having the highest court in the federal system acknowledge that regardless of the bad actions by many actors, including the state and others, to deteriorate that sense of home, the Supreme Court recognized that our home was never destroyed. Our reservation remains. And that is powerful for any Creek Nation citizen. That resonates with Native people across the land who have similar stories of being strangers in their own land. We haven't been erased from our own history. We haven't been erased from our own lands. It's about as powerful as it gets for us.
Well, Ambassador Chowdhury, this is something you alluded to a little earlier. There are people who are fear-mongering about this decision, people in leadership positions in the government. Florida Republican Senator Ted Cruz tweeted this after the SCOTUS decision, quote, Neil Gorsuch and the four liberal justices just gave away half of Oklahoma, literally. Manhattan is next, end quote. What do you make of people drumming up fear about this decision?
Well, that statement is very representative of a lot of the sky is falling rhetoric that's been floating around this case. It's my understanding that literally means actually true. What we point out is this decision doesn't say anything close to that. Not one inch of land changed hands in this decision. Not one grain of sand changed hands. What this decision did was simply affirm that our boundaries have never been destroyed, have never been disestablished. And so to basically stoke the fires of fear when there's no basis in the law is unfortunate at best. I mean, that's the kindest way to speak to that. And so no land has changed hands. We're only empowered by the clarity of the Supreme Court's decision to further work hand in hand with other governments to ensure that everybody's protected in our borders. To be sure, there's going to be some, there's a lot of work to do, but we're prepared to do that. We've got a long history of working with our federal, state, and local partners, and that will continue. And now that the playing field is clarified, I've got no doubt that we'll roll up our sleeves together and look out for the public interest together. So that rhetoric, inflammatory rhetoric, has done nothing to help with that collaborative process. But now we're all in it together, and today's a new day, and we're looking forward to moving in cooperation to protect everyone within our borders.
Professor Deere, Neil Gorsuch, Trump administration appointee, was the only conservative judge to rule in favor of the SCOTUS decision. And he wrote, quote, "Today we are asked whether the land these treaties promised remains an Indian reservation for purposes of federal criminal law. Because Congress has not said otherwise, we hold the government to its word. He also said, on the far end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. Forced to leave their ancestral lands in Georgia and Alabama, the Creek Nation received assurances that their new lands in the West would be secure forever. In exchange for ceding all their land east of the Mississippi River, the U.S. government agreed by treaty that the Creek country west of the Mississippi shall be solemnly guaranteed to the Creek Indians," end quote. What do you think about Neil Gorsuch and how he wrote about this decision, Professor Deere?
Well, as our ambassador mentioned, it was a very emotional read. We had some hope that Gorsuch would write this decision, and we knew that it was going to be a close vote. There was no doubt about that, because the very same legal question came before the court last year in a case called Murphy. And that was the exact same legal question, which ended in a tie. And so they didn't issue an opinion in that case. And then Gorsuch joined the bench, and we knew Gorsuch had written Indian law decisions that were that seemed to be suggesting he has a reading of treaties that would help tribes. And so when he joined the Supreme Court and this new case came about, I think I always knew it would be 5-4. But we were really hoping that Gorsuch would write this. And not only did he write the decision in and restore or re-recognize our boundaries, he wrote it in such rhetoric that it became very emotional to read, to say that at the end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. I never expected anyone at the Supreme Court to even acknowledge that history. So to acknowledge it and write so well and eloquently combined for a very emotional read, although I want to say that Gorsuch used, you know, a close reading of the law and a very logical analysis, but to read it as a Muskogee person was very emotional.
When we talk about the Supreme Court these days, we hear a lot about conservative justices and liberal justices. When it comes to these issues, Native issues, do they fall along those typical partisan lines?
You know, not really. Sometimes, but we've had Clarence Thomas support a tribal position. We've had Ruth Bader Ginsburg not support tribal interests at times. So Indian law is one of those kind of quirky areas where it doesn't necessarily fall down the sort of liberal conservative lines that we typically talk about with the Supreme Court.
And a quick clarification, we misstated that Ted Cruz is a Florida senator. He's a Texas senator. Ambassador Chowdhury, we just got a couple of minutes here. Last week, a federal judge ordered the temporary closure of the highly controversial Dakota Access Pipeline for an environmental review. Why is this an important issue for Native tribes?
Well, to build on the professor's comment, Justice Gorsuch's position in McGirt is notable for all the reasons they mentioned, but also it's intellectually honest. If Justice Gorsuch believed in the text of the laws, that leads to the decision. Similarly, with the Dakota Access case, just speaking as a Native American and not as ambassador, I'm thankful that the court in that case recognized that the interest of the public as well as Indian country, and preserving the environment and preserving our waterways and preserving public health, safety, and welfare should be fully considered before any easements are granted. That's a matter of the law. That's part of the law, as the decision in that case pointed out. And that case will, of course, have several appeals moving forward. And so I don't want to speak as ambassador to that case by any means. But personally, whenever the court recognizes the legal fact that the law requires input from the public as well as tribal nations whose lands through treaty and trust responsibilities should be considered in these decisions, whenever the courts recognize that those interests must be taken into account during these federal decisions, that is encouraging. And so it's a different case than the McGirt case, but some of the textual principles that are at play are important. But I can't speak to that specifically as ambassador.
Very, very quickly, in just a few seconds, Professor Bland said, do you think this is an encouraging step forward for Native American activists?
Yes, I think it's incredibly encouraging, and I'm kind of looking. This decision the other day just kind of renews your confidence in a future in which, our presence is noted, and that there's greater understanding of not only Native history but federal Indian law. So I think the skies look a lot better and clearer moving forward, and the future looks that much more brighter.
That's Professor Kent Blassett with the University of Kansas, Professor Sarah Deer with the University of Kansas, and Ambassador Jonadev Chowdhury. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Still to come, the Washington, D.C. football team changed its name. We'll talk to two people who have been concerned about the team's mascot for years, and we'll hear more from you. I'm Jen White.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Luminary, presenting their new original podcast, Murder on the Towpath, a captivating true crime miniseries hosted by journalist Soledad O'Brien that explores the 1964 murder of Mary Pinchot Meyer in Georgetown, D.C., and the resulting trial that rocked the country. Listen to Murder on the Towpath only on Luminary. Go to luminary.link/towpath and get a 7-day free trial of Luminary's original podcasts. Cancel anytime. Terms apply.
What do you do when you have too many pickles in Alaska and not enough pancake syrup in New Jersey? On the next episode of Planet Money's Summer School, we send supply and demand to the rescue. It's the economics education you always wanted but never got around to. Every Wednesday, listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
Now let's get back to our conversation about victories for Native American rights this week. After years of campaigning by Native American activists and the recent worldwide movement against racial injustice, sports teams are reconsidering the use of Native Americans as mascots. Washington team's owner Dan Snyder said that he, quote, would never change the name. It's that simple. Never. You can use the caps, end quote. But the team is now changing their name to one without a racial slur. Here to talk about it is Amanda Blackhorse. She's long advocated for changing the name. She was the lead plaintiff in the Supreme Court case Blackhorse v. Pro Football, which pushed to define the R word as offensive. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Professor Stephanie Freiberg, professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. She's the first person to study the psychological impact Native American mascots have on Native American children. She's also a member of the Tulalip tribes. Professor Freiberg, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
And I want to kick off our conversation with a voicemail we got from Dee in Virginia.
I'm excited about the successes for the Native American people. It's long overdue. Long overdue. I'm thankful for the climate that causes Americans and people all over the world to finally come to terms with the truth about our heritage, the truth about Native Americans, the truth about African Americans and the contribution and treatment, and it's long overdue.
Thanks, Dee, for sharing your thoughts with us. Amanda, you and others have been fighting this fight for years to have the Washington football team change its name. How did you react when they announced that this was going to actually happen?
I honestly didn't believe it. I am very cynical, and I'm very cynical when it comes to the team and their intentions and just because of their history and how they have interacted or not interacted with Native people. So I'm still actually quite skeptical of their plans moving forward. They did not make it clear that they will not use Native imagery moving forward. They did say that they would retire the name and logo, which, you know, for us, it is a monumental time because Native people have been advocating against this for decades. But I'm just still looking forward, very skeptical. I want to ensure that they will rebrand with no Native imagery and no Native names at all moving forward.
Can you talk about the years of advocacy that led to this moment? Because like I said, this has not been a short-term fight for you.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's been, the legal case was in court for about 15 years. We didn't actually make it to the Supreme Court. We were headed in that direction, but our case was dropped along the way because of a separate Supreme Court case. And so being a part of it for 15 years, I mean, that's a very, very long time. I started when I was about 24 years old. And so I kind of grew up with it. My co-plaintiffs were around the same age as well. And so it's always kind of was a part of our lives. And I mean, it's just legal court cases just take forever. Prior to that, Suzanne Harjo's case started in 1992. So we had been in litigation with this franchise for over 25 years. And so it's just been a long process. It ended in 2017. And so that was a difficult loss to really take in because we put so much forth. There's so many sacrifices that have been made.
What motivated
you? So many resources
you?
Used, what, and it was difficult.
What motivated you to keep this fight going?
Well, I mean, I think we just have to have that resilience. We just have to, think about our children, think about their future. And Dr. Freiberg will talk more about that, about how this impacts our children. I want our future generations to grow up in a world where they don't have to turn on the TV and see cultural appropriation right there in front of them. You know, they don't have to sit in uncomfortable conversations with their peers talking about the Washington R word and needing to have to explain that to people and why it's racist. So that's really, I think, why a lot of us do it is because we want to make a better world for our children.
We got this email from Sherry who says, I am Muskogee and Choctaw and live in Oklahoma. I listen to 1A on KGOU. She says, I am relieved they're changing their name. The old name is racist, shameful, and backward. It makes Native people feel awkward with attention focused on us when we don't want it. It's especially awkward when you are the only brown person in the room. You are that symbol to some people. Changing the name is a sign that certain accepted ideas aren't acceptable anymore. It shows the world that we as a nation do abide by the belief that all men are created equal. Professor Freiberg, explain some of what you found in your research.
So what we found is we did experiments where we exposed Native children to mascots or to a control condition where we didn't expose them to anything. And what we saw is that across a variety of studies, it lowered self-esteem, lowered achievement-related future goals, and lowered Native children's belief that their community could improve itself and enhance its future.
I can think, well, I've heard this argument before, people who say, it's just a mascot, it doesn't mean anything. But why is a sports mascot and who it depicts and how so important?
Well, if you look at across psychology, if you look at what predicts well-being in terms of psychological well-being, how psychology predicts other outcomes such as academic achievement or income, what you see is that all of those variables are predicted by identity. And so when people have a strong identity, when they feel good about who they are, all of those indicators go up. They're better. And so really, the sports mascot issue is one way in which the American public is given license to demean and mock Native people publicly and often. And so when you contrast it with other groups in America who, for whom many of the exact same behaviors are seen as inappropriate and demeaning and dehumanizing, when you start comparing them, it becomes easier to recognize the systemic discrimination that's happening to Native people. So the sports mascot issue is so much bigger. I've heard people say what you just said thousands of times, like, isn't it just a sports mascot? It isn't. It's literally someone's identity. And our identity is powerful. Who, how we think about ourselves, what we think is possible for ourselves in the future, predicts our motivation, our behavior, just literally everything about being healthy human beings is tied to ourselves and our identities.
Really quickly, we got this email from Matt who says, a number of years ago, I attended North American Indian Days in Browning, Montana. There were large numbers of members of various tribes wearing the Washington football team's gear. There didn't appear to be an issue. Please discuss. Amanda, has there been tension as you've fought this fight to have the name changed?
Yes. You know, Native people, we're very diverse. There's so many different tribes. There's over 570 tribes. Federally recognized tribes in this country. So we all don't think the same. We all don't have the same experiences. And yes, there are Native people out there who do like the Washington team and their name and logo. There are Native schools out there who do have Native mascots. I mean, that is another conversation that we need to have. And that's for, I think, another day. You know, we're not a monolithic people. But we also need to point out the fact that the team created this foundation called the Original Americans Foundation back in 2014, or I believe it was 2013.
We've only got a few seconds.
Where they actually funded Native people. They actually gave money to Native tribes and organization and gave them Native clothing with their logo on it. So, I mean, it's very complicated. We need to talk about that.
All right. We've been talking with Amanda Blackhorse and Professor Stephanie Freiberg with the University of Michigan. Thanks to you both for taking the time to talk about this. Remember, we have a text club. We'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us, and details about how to sign up can be found in Ask 1A tab at 1A.org. This conversation was produced by Katie Klein with help from Hector Arzade. It was edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the 1A.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.